Hello and welcome to A Responsible Day for the fifth day of Nisan. My name is Gideon Rothstein, and today we will study together a responsible of the Netziv of Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin in Shut Meshiv Davar, Chelek Bet Siman Mem Chet. Date of the fifth of Nisan of Tov Resh Mem Gimel of 1883. Let's thank the OU, Rabbi Jacob Ramut and David Hachhauser, for their assistance in this project in helping us all learn some responses together, many responses together. So today's response is about the man had asked him a question that a man, the questioner is the Rav, I think, but the Rav of a man who had a custom to give half of his Maaser Ksafim. Let's remember, Maaser Ksafim is the long-standing custom that when Jews earn money, they give a tenth of it to various tzedakah purposes. They get to choose which tzedakah purposes. Maaser Ksafim is the practice to give a tenth of one's salary, of one's income, it doesn't have to be salary, of one's income, to tzedakah. So tzedakah is often left up to the person involved. It's not a specific tzedakah, not a specific charity, or even a specific type of charity. So this man had the practice to give half of his Maaser Ksafim, and this is 1883, let's remember, half of his tzedakah money, of his this tenth that he was giving to good mitzvah purposes, I guess is even the better way to say it, to a charity called Rabbi Meir Baal HaNes. Rabbi Meir Baal HaNes is not today, I think, as active a charity as it was, or as prominent a charity as it was, but in the 1880s, it was the way that money was sent to mostly the old yeshiv, mostly, I think, those who had been living in Israel for a long time, a way of supporting them, because there wasn't really a viable economy in Israel. So there were many, many people who were poor living in Eretz Israel, and Rabbi Meir Baal HaNes helped support many of them, and I think it also helped with the new yeshiv, with the new settlers to some extent. So this man had decided to give half of his money, basically, to building up Eretz Yisrael, half of his tzedakah money, of his mitzvah money, of his ma'aser ksafim money, of his tenth of his income money, and the other half, he would give to the poor people who came to his door, poor causes, local poor causes. That was his practice. Then his brother sadly passes away and leaves behind young children who need a melamed. So, you know, I don't know how wealthy this man is, I don't know how much money he does, and I don't know how much we're talking about, and I don't know how the melamed was going to work, but it's an interesting reminder that before you had Torah day schools, before you had yeshivas, kitanas, or whatever version of that you want to say, so the way that people got educated was, there was no like schools, although it's odd to understand why there were no schools, because that goes back to the time of the Gemara was the idea of set up schools, but he had to hire some kind of a private tutor, basically, for his nieces and nephews, as for Torah Tefillah, to teach them Torah, to whatever extent, it's unclear to me what extent, and how to daven. And that was sort of the structure, the curriculum of a Jewish education. So the man now wants to know, can he, that's an expensive proposition, can he turn all of his maaser money? He assumes, and it's not questioned in the responsum, that the half of the maaser money, the half of the tenth money that he had been giving until now to other poor, he can give to these children because they're very poor. The question is, the money that he'd been giving to Rabbi Meir Baal HaNes didn't specifically go to poor people. It went to the building up of Eretz Yisrael. It's a different mitzvah. And is that money so dedicated to that mitzvah that he's not allowed to convert it back to this one? Or how would it be that he would have to go about doing it? So that's part one of the question, and then it happens to be he throws it in, and it's going to end up being crucial to the actual answer at the end, to the practical conduct of this man at the end. But the rabbi is asking the question, sort of throws in, but the man had added that he doesn't remember if he made an actual ned there, an actual articulation of a vow or a promise. So the question is, if this man now, who has these nieces and nephews who need a melamed, who need somebody to teach them Torah Tefillah, question to the Netziv was, does he need to do Hataras Nedarim? Does he need to release that vow before he can do so? Or can he just convert the money for those purposes? So the Netziv starts with a Psak in Shulchan Aruch and Or Chaim in Tuf Kuf Samachet 568. The question there was, let's say, that used to be the custom was that people would fast Aseres Yimei Tshuva. There's a whole question about whether you can fast Rosh Hashanah. So some did and some didn't, but they would fast all the other days of Aseres Yimei Tshuva, and they wouldn't fast Shabbos either. And you're not allowed to fast on the ninth day of Tishrei. The Gemara talks about the fact that you have to eat that day, the ninth day of Tishrei. So that happens to be the source of the custom to say Slichos for at least 4 days before Rosh Hashanah. It's to make up for those 4 days that you can't fast in those things. So the Shulchan Aruch's discussion is, a person who has the practice of fasting all the 10 days of Aseres Yimei Tshuva, and then a bris happens in town. Not a bris of his son, But another bris, and it's a mitzvah to join in the Seudas Mitzvah of the bris. That's why we call it a Seudas Mitzvah. It's an obligation of some sort to join in that celebration. So the Shulchan Aruch rules, this person whose practice was to fast this day, long-standing practice, and the reason that we have to worry about long-standing practice is that long-standing practices can take on the nature of an oath or a vow. Even if you don't actually articulate a vow, they can have that sense of it to it as well. So the question was, has this man already committed to... So, does this man have to fast this day, or can he join in the bris? The answer is, the halacha in Shulchan Aruch is, he doesn't need hatara on the vow, because... Now, the way the Shulchan Aruch says it is kilo nahagulita not b'chi hai gavna. Custom never was to fast in such a situation. So it sounds like, says the Nativ, I think you could have argued on this, but my role here isn't to argue, but I think you could have argued on this particular aspect of it. He says it sounds like what the Shulchan Aruch means is that the custom that developed was to fast unless something happened that would make you want to eat for a mitzvah purpose, but after those regular kinds of things, meaning that this man or woman, they're obviously talking about men, but this man who took on this practice of fasting on the Aser Shabbat Tshuva was following an established practice already. There was an established custom that the established custom that he took on, even whether or not he knew it, assumed within it that things could happen, like a Seudas Mitzvah, a Bris Milah. Now, Bris Milah is an important example because it's an example that comes up frequently. So that could be the kind of example that people would generally assume. So therefore, the general assumption is that when a person starts fasting on Aser Shabbat Tshuva, they have it not directly in mind, but sort of latently in mind. They have it somewhere in there that if something should come up that regularly comes up, they would obviously not fast that year. And that, in other words, is not a breaking of the vow. It's not a deviation from the custom. That was always the custom. That would mean then, and this is an important one, that would mean then that if something came up that was unexpected, that people didn't generally assume would happen, then you couldn't say that was the custom of the people who were taking on this idea of fasting Aser Shabbat Tshuva. So the example he gives to me was an interesting one, because he says, the Nativ says, so something happens, this person is not feeling well, and there's a mitzvah to eat. First off, I want to note, a mitzvah to eat, because taking care of ourselves, the Nitziv is saying, is obviously a mitzvah to eat. But interestingly, he doesn't assume, and I'm not sure why he doesn't assume that that would be something that people would expect as well, meaning a bris milah in the community. He says, oh, whoever started this custom of fasting and sesh mechuvah, they would clearly assume that brisin would happen. But he seems to be saying, but they wouldn't assume that illness would happen. I'm not sure why that would be true, but it doesn't matter because the principle is the same. He's saying that if the custom to fast included in it the expectation of this exception that would force one to eat, so then too, you could eat. But if it was an unexpected thing, then you couldn't do it because that was not embedded in the original custom as an exception. And therefore, if you want to deviate, now let's remember, if you want to deviate, you can do hataras and darim. You can go to a chacham, you can go to a rabbi who was expert at these issues and find a way to say that the original neder should no longer be in effect. So that's halach. And he says that's halach in your day as well, that if a mixus chuli happens, you need a hatara. And that's the way the shach reads it. Magid Avram, whose sefer is only on Or Chaim, Tavkuf Pe Aleph, Sivkot and Yudbet in 581, his note number 12, doesn't accept this exception. He says if somebody gets a little ill, he doesn't need Hatara. So he doesn't need to release the vow. So the Tiff says it seems like he's ignoring what the Mechaber said in Yeredeya, that Mixas Choli, you do have to release the vow. And again, I have to think to myself, the Mogad Avram simply might have assumed that a Mixas Choli does qualify as an unexpected kind of an event, and that's why you don't need a Hatara. But the Dogel Merivava in Yoredeya explains that the distinction is, the Dogel Merivava suggests, the distinction is that in Yoredeya we were talking about that the Mixas Choli leads the person to decide they don't want to go back to this Minhag ever again. See, if you're going to use this instance to lead to an uprooting of the minhag of the custom completely, so that would need a hatara. But if somebody got ill one time, and they therefore that one time needed to eat, that would be where the Magen Avraham is discussing. So you have now expected breaks to a practice. So expected breaks to a practice become embedded in the original assumption of the practice, don't require hatara. And then the Magen Avraham seems to think that it might be even unexpected breaks in a practice don't require hatara, as long as there's a mitzvah purpose that you're switching, that's leading you to switch, as long as it's a a one-time switch or an occasional switch. If it's going to be a permanent switch, so that would be where the Dagal Miravava, who is really also known as the Rabbi Yehuda, that's where the Dagal Miravava explained would require Hatara according to the Shulchan Aruch. So now that would seem to mean, says the Nitziv, that if you're going to switch one mitzvah to another mitzvah, long term, for some period of time, it would seem to need a Hatara. So according to the Shach, it would be clearly understandable, because he says it's only when a mitzvah derabin comes along, it's only in a mitzvah that many, many people do, that you have this embedded idea of switches or not switches, because he followed their assumed practices, and that's how he got to where he got to, and therefore whatever rules they have for when you can switch or not switch would apply to him as well. But when it comes to our case, he thinks the Magen Avraham, the Nagam Rivava, would also think you need Hatara. Now why? Because you're switching to another mitzvah. So you're going to do it all the time that the orphans need it, even if it's going to be only for 1 year, he says, the Siv says. It seems to him that since this is a custom that he took on his own, and in taking on the custom on his own, he didn't embed any exceptions into it. So then whatever comes up is going to need a Hatar, meaning he's understanding that the whole reason why one can break those fasts for particular purposes without a Hatara, without a releasing of the vow, the whole underlying reason for that is that there's a communal practice that shaped the nature of that custom. But once the custom we're talking about is not a custom that was taken on by a community or by a group or by a known, you know, section of people, but it's a particular person, that person doesn't embed. Now, I'm not sure why he's so sure of this. I don't know why I couldn't. This is me talking, and I know that you don't necessarily want to hear from me, so if I'm doing this wrong, I apologize. And as always, I give you my email, grothst@gmail.com, and feel free to contact me about this issue. But it seems to me that you could have argued that anything's expected should be considered to have been subsumed in that original custom. And I could have imagined arguing, once we see that in cases of fasting on Sesh Yemei Teshuvah, that there's an assumption that if another valuable mitzvah purpose comes up, that can temporarily break that practice, I would think that that might lead us to generally understand that when we take on practices, we have an embedded assumption that these are practices that we're taking on for when there's not some other pressing mitzvah need to change that practice. That is not, however, the way the Nitziv takes it. So let's continue learning from the Nitziv. So he assumes, to reiterate, that the Magen Avraham would agree that if there's no mitzvah derabin, there's no practice that the public shapes our understanding of it, so then you need a Hatara, you need to release a vow in order to be able to switch it to another mitzvah. And he infers it from the end of the words there, where the Magen Avraham says, "Im lo mishe mitaneh yoter mimashenagu atibor." Unless we're talking in the case of fasting on Sesh Yemei Teshuvah, somebody who has a practice to fast more than whatever the community does, and therefore the Nitziv understands it to mean that he is not being guided by the community's community practice, and therefore we'd have to assume that he'd not be guided by the community exceptions as well. So once again, I can say that may be true, but that's only because he explicitly showed through his actions that he's not following their communal standards, but where he's setting up his own thing. Anyway, I've belabored my views enough. Let's continue on in the Nitziv. So this guy is doing something with his tzedakah money, with his meiser money, which is fine, but it's his own personal practice. That should mean that if he needs to change it, he's going to need a Hatara. That's all one line, everything the Nitziv gives, that he's now going to change. Aval ani adati ain okay. Now, see, he said to himself, so why did he present that to begin with? I think it might be that he presented it to begin with because that was an intuitive way of reading it. He wanted to make clear that he understood that way of comprehending the whole thing, and now he wants to say, well, he doesn't see it that way. And he says that he thinks that as long as the person who took on a practice did not articulate a promise, a neder or a shavua, right, with some articulation, he only did it as a good, valid practice. Now, it happens to be, this is the wrinkle in this discussion, that he was assuming until now, happens to be that when Jews take on good, fine practices, so let's call it a custom for a second. The definition of custom, I think, is more complicated, but let's call it for a custom. A custom. He takes on a custom, and it's a good custom, right? There's nothing wrong with it, right? The idea of giving ma'isik safim is a custom that many, many people have. So let's say you take on that custom. You haven't done it until now. You didn't grow up in a family where they expressed our tzedakah needs that way, and person takes it on, or any other good custom. So what's the level of obligation? So you can say it's a custom. So it happens to be that the halacha has long assumed that that falls under the rubric of the verse. Rishonim already understand it from a Gemara in Nedarim, that falls under the rubric of the verse, lo yachel divaro, One cannot treat one's words profanely, which is taken to mean that there are certain things that... So that's in the context of oaths, of nidarim, of vows or oaths, however you want to understand that kind of a promise. A neder is a very specific kind of a thing, but the Torah says, lo yachel divaro, you can't make it profane, meaning you can't treat it as if it wasn't important. It's a sacred obligation because you took it upon yourself. You have to fulfill it. And the Gemara in nidarim, that's not our issue right now, applies that to just practices that people take on, even though they don't articulate it and they don't say a vow, they don't say an oath. Nonetheless, it has much of that quality to it, and that it obligates us not to be mechel divareinu. So the Netziv thinks, though, that that doesn't go as far as to say that even if there's a mitzvah that comes our way, that we can't change it without a hatara, that we would need a hatara, we would need to release our vow before we could change it. Because the Gemara in Pesachim on Aleph Amud Beis talks about places where, talks about a lot of things with minhag, and what happens when people from one place come to another place, and their customs, their practices are different. So one of the examples is doing malacha, doing work, I think either on Tisha B'Av or also on Erev Pesach in the morning, on the 14th of Nisan in the morning. Some people have the practice to do work, some people have the practice not to do work. So the assumption of the Gemara is, my practice is not to do work, and I come to a place where they do work, I don't have to do work with them because there's no obvious changing from their practice. But the Rush writes that if it wasn't possible without a machloket, now I want to stress the Rush makes it clear that he thinks a machloket, but the Gemara says that we have to worry about acting differently than people around us because the machloket, the Rush means, seems to mean, that it's going to break communal peace. And what he says is that if I refrain from work, it would create some kind of fight among us. There would be some kind of dispute, and there was no way to avoid the dispute other than if I do malacha with them. If I am a permanent place where we don't do malacha, we don't work on Erev Pesach on the 14th in the morning, and they do, and they come to a place, if they notice they're not, they're going to get very upset and they're going to have a problem. So the Rush says he thinks you have to do it because he says there's no Isidore, so there's no prohibition against working. It's a custom, and therefore you have to break your custom to avoid machloket, to avoid strife. So the Netziv is saying that that shows that the whole idea of lo yechel dvaro is not that a custom, we have to keep a custom, it's not like it's a full oath, because it was a full oath and you have to change it for these people, you have to get a hatar. So when the Rush can say you change it because you have to avoid strife, what the Rush is really saying is there's no full oath here in that sense of an oath. He gives another example, Gemara in Brachos, that he thinks is even more explicit. Gemara in Brachos is on Vav Amud Bet, Ravin, I think Breder of Ada, says the name of Yochanan, that anybody who generally comes to shul in the morning and one day doesn't come, Kadosh Baruch Hu asks about him. Shenamar, mi bachem yirei Hashem shomei v'kalav. Who of you is fears Hashem and listens to the asher halach chashechim and listens to the voice of his servant, asher halach chashechim, who walks in darkest vein darkness, vein noga lo, and there is no light for him. But then the Gemara says, even dvar mitzvah halach noga lo. But if the person isn't in shul because they had some other mitzvah purpose that kept them from shul, then noga lo, there will be light for that person. So that, how does that show that you're allowed to switch to mitzvos in personal practices? You're allowed to switch to mitzvos, according to the Netziv, even if you never assumed it explicitly within the personal practice when you started it. He says here, first thing, dangerous thing to say out loud, but he says, Ein chiyu l'chol adam le'lech b'palel dafk l'veid ha'knesset. We today talk about going to minyan as being such an important thing, and I think it is, but it's just that there's no specific mitzvah, there's a specific obligation that a person has to go daven at shul. But whoever gets used to it, it becomes like a nut and neder, like an oath, in the sense that we said before, that you can't violate lo yechel dvaro, such that if that person changes one day, Hashem calls him to account for it, and then if he went for a mitzvah purpose, then it's all good. So the Netziv says that's exactly right. The person took on a personal practice of going to shul. Again, I think you could argue on that one. His vision, his view of the level of obligation in davening in shul is much, much lower than we tend to say today. And he's the Netziv. He certainly has the right to say such things. But if I say that that level of obligation is that low to that extent, that it's really sort of a personal practice when it starts going to shul, that's fine. But then the rest of the Gemara then reads perfectly for the Netziv's understanding of what it means when I take on a personal practice. I took on a personal practice, I go to shul, Hashem calls me to account for it because of lo yechel divaro, because of the requirement not to treat our words and our good practices lightly. But if the answer is the person didn't go to shul that day for a mitzvah purpose, then great. And he says, that's not like the Magen Avraham. So again, I don't know if it's not like the Magen Avraham or not, but that's the way the Nitziv is understanding it, that the assumption is that in personal practices, that even if there's some other good mitzvah, that if some of the good mitzvah purpose comes along, then you're clearly allowed to go and do that. And then that explains, if the Dagon Revolver is right, that it's only when you're fully uprooting a custom you need Hatara Nidarim, that makes sense also, because you need the Hatara because you're trying to get rid of it completely. But in any case, when there's some other mitzvah, any other mitzvah, Mitzvah Scholi, a little bit of not feeling well, whatever the other mitzvah might be, any such a thing that would cause a temporary deviation from the original practice, that's fine because it's another mitzvah purpose and there's no problem with that. That's what the Nitziv ends up thinking about it. And therefore, in our case, right, so even if it were true that the children, let's say, are 7, 6, and 5, and he plans to continue their education with this money through the age of 18, which was old in those days, they wouldn't have done it that long. But let's say that it's his argument would be that's fine because the whole time that he's doing that, he's switching it to another mitzvah purpose. And as long as you're not uprooting the minhag, uprooting the personal custom, you just switch it to another mitzvah purpose with the intention to return when the pressure goes away, that shouldn't require hatara. So you might say, well, once he's gotten so used to supporting them, and then once they get older and they don't need him anymore, maybe he won't go back to the practice. He says, there's no reason to worry about that. Apparently, people had worried about that and said, maybe you need hatara in case that's what happens in the end. He says, you have to worry about that because this is a man, he says, who, look at this, he of his own volition would separate half his money from the ma'aser ksafim money, from the tithing money, and would give it to a mitzvah to Remeir Bal Hanes that he, not that he made up the mitzvah, but that was not the common practice in his time. So a person like that, you don't have to worry about it. And then, so that all would have worked to help the man be allowed to do this without Hatar Nedarim. But then he says, the problem is, the man thinks he might have made an explicit neder. And that becomes the problem. If he thinks he, because since he thinks he might have, so a neder beferush, an explicit neder, doesn't have any of these exceptions to it unless he made them out loud. Meaning if somebody says, as a neder, I take an oath, it really would be a shivua. But let's say somebody makes it as a neder, which would be something like saying, I prohibit upon myself, like it would be hekdesh, all eating on those days of Rosh Hashanah Tshuva that people fast, meaning except for the first 2 days of Rosh Hashanah, except for Shabbos of Rosh Hashanah Tshuva, and except for the ninth day of Tishrei, for Erev Yom Kippur, I make it, and I'm not saying that as an example to help in the shiur. I don't want it to sound like I'm making it there. The person says, I want all food to be prohibited to me for those other days as if they were hektish. That will need a hatar, because unless the person said, unless a mitzvah purpose comes along and then I should be allowed to eat, then it doesn't become part of the neder. And then there's an actual neder. So an actual oath, and it seems pointing out, is much more serious than even our common, starting from the Gemara practice, to assume that lo yachil divaro, that I am not allowed to treat, that, and none of us are allowed to treat our good words lightly, doesn't mean that it's actually a neder in that way. Now, it's a suffik, however, and the suffik here is about whether he has to give the money to Rav Meir Bal Hanes' that charity of supporting the land of Israel, or to these orphans, his nieces and nephews. So you might have argued, says the Nitziv, there's a Ran in Nedarim who says that anytime we have a doubt about giving charity, what we should do with charity money, that's a financial issue. And in financial issues, we always rule that suffik mamon lekula, that a doubt about monetary issues can be ruled leniently. But so that's the Ran. And we often accept that Ran. But the Nitziv says the Rashba and the Ramban disagree. And not only that, another issue comes up here, but since it's possible to just do a Hatarat Nedarim, to find a rabbi to explain the situation, and he'll find ways in which we can say that this neder shouldn't apply. It was made misunderstanding the circumstances, and whenever you make a neder with a mistake in it, you can be matir the neder, the chacham can be matir the neder. So when you can do that, then we would always say a suffik is usher. Then we say cases of doubt, we have to rule stringently. And why is that? So there's a Rashi in Be'ah that he refers us to, and a Ran in Nedarim as well. But the point is that when we talk about things, the example is of this, is what's called the Davar She'esh Lo Matirim. Davar She'esh Lo Matirim is something which there's a way to, there's something that's possibly usher. And there's, so it's possibly us, possibly not us, but it's Davar She'esh Lo Matirim, or it's possible that it was batel, that it fell into a mixture, so much so that ordinarily we'd be allowed to ignore it. But since it's Davar She'esh Lo Matirim, there's a way to take partake of it that would be fully, fully permissible. That's what it means by Davar She'esh Lo Matirim. It's a way to take partake of it to be fully permissible. Then the halacha is we don't allow it to become batel. We don't say, even if it's mixed in with 1,000 other things, so it's a minuscule percentage of whatever it's part of, we don't allow that to say that we can ignore it because there's no reason to. Because since you can do it in a fully permissible way, why should you allow yourself to rely on nullification? So too, says the Netziv here, when you can do a hatara, you can release the vow, and therefore you can do it in a permissible way, even if were to be true that the principle is safek b'mon al hakel, that with a doubt and money we can rule leniently, but we don't allow ourselves to. That's true of other things as well, but we don't allow ourselves to rely on halachic outs, not because the halachic outs are invalid, they're very valid. We don't allow ourselves to rely on them, however, because there's a way to do it without relying on them, in which it's even more fully and clearly permissible. So therefore, the man should try to do hatar nedarim. Now, another wrinkle is that you don't usually be matir nidre mitzvah. If somebody makes an oath to do a mitzvah, then we don't usually allow hatar for that because we don't want people giving up on their commitment to perform mitzvot. But here, you're doing it for another mitzvah, so that should be good enough. And therefore, I think the man should do hatar nedarim and then support his nieces and nephews, probably in that case, actually, it's probably mostly his nephews, but support them so they can get the education that they need with the money that's available. Now, the rest of the tshuva, there's a little bit more to the tshuva, and I don't think we're going to get to all of it, but it's a potpourri of other questions. So our main topic for today, and so I'll sort of fake close up now, and then do probably one more question. Our main topic of today was, are you allowed to switch money from one mitzvah purpose to the next? And that got us the whole question of the nature of what it means to undertake a mitzvah, and when we're allowed to temporarily or permanently change that undertaking, and what we do or don't need for it, and when we do or don't need hatara, release from such a practice. The next question that we'll have, probably the last one we'll have a chance to take up, is let's say it's a Motzei Shabbat when it's early in the month, and therefore the community should be doing Kiddush Levana. So you do have Havdalah first in Shul, or do Kiddush Levana, which comes first. So the Netziv says, you know, whenever we talk about doing things first, that whole question only arises when both things come up at the same time. And at this moment, we can fulfill both. But when it comes to Havdalah in Shul, as opposed to Kiddush Levana, it's not true yet. Because before Kiddush Levana, before, you know, celebrating the new moon becomes an issue and an obligation, you have to be outside. Because you can't do Kiddush Levana unless you're outside seeing the moon. But the Havdalah is already an issue because here it is, Motzei Shabbat. Shabbat is ending, and I'm in Shul, and the Shul practice is to do Havdalah. So therefore, it seems to me very clear, that it's very clear, that that's the mitzvah that's available to us. You do that mitzvah because it's right there. You don't push it aside. Ein machmitzin et mitzvah. We don't let the mitzvah leaven, as it were. We don't push the mitzvah aside. We just do the mitzvah right away. So he points out the Gemara in Tzvachim has a similar example on Daf Tzadi Aleph on page 91, where they ask about Tadi v'sheino Tadi Tadi Kodem, and then they talk about the case. So let's say the person shechted the sheino Tadi first for whatever reason. That was probably an error, but let's say he did that. Do we say that you should have somebody stir the blood so it not congeal, so it not go bad, and wait its turn, and then go and do the tadir one's mitzvah and shecht it and offer it, and then come back to this one to finish up the offering of it? The Gemara concludes there. No, you finish the sheino tadir because right now the sheino tadir, even though it's a less common sacrifice, it's already present. It's already presenting itself for sprinkling on the altar. Whereas the tadir one, the regular sacrifice, has not yet presented itself because it hasn't yet been slaughtered. So it might be that there was an error in slaughtering this one first, for all we know. But once it's slaughtered, it has now presented itself for the sprinkling. So when it comes to sprinkling on the Mizbeach, on the altar, we don't have the presence of a tadir, of a common one, waiting to be done, because it's not waiting yet. So that, for the Netziv, is strong proof of this idea that he said, the Kiddush Levana has not yet presented itself as an option, because we haven't yet gone outside to see the moon, so you do Havdalah first. From there, he points out that the man had asked the question about Rabbi Akiva Eiger, who held that we do Havdalah to Oraita first, and that's why over, not Kiddush Levana, but over Svira. Svira Saomer, between Pesach and Shavuos, is in our days, according to most opinions, a derabbanan, a rabbinic thing. So that's why Rabbi Akiva Eiger said, we say Havdalah first before the Svira. So the man writing to the Netziv says, but I don't understand Havdalah is in Shul. Havdalah is derabbanan. Everybody agrees Havdalah is derabbanan. The real Havdalah, he means to be saying, is the one you do at home. So the Netziv says, I don't think that's true at all. We say Havdalah in Shul. Now, this is his claim. We say Havdalah in Shul to fulfill the obligation of somebody, anybody who doesn't have wine. Meaning, he's not saying of guests who live in Shul, but anybody who happens not to have wine. So I note his assumption that there are people in Shul who don't have wine, aren't going to be able to drink Havdalah later, and this is their Havdalah. So And those people will not have dal again in their homes. That would be a d'oraita. So that's a whole question that you get into, but we certainly don't have the time for that. So therefore, we'll just end by pointing out, he says, but the whole assumption of the of Rabbi Akiva Eiger that you put a d'oraita before the rabban, he's not sure that's true either, and he doesn't get into that. We will stop here. There's a very little bit more to the tshuva, but we'll stop here. The response of the day for the fifth day of Nisan. Thank you for joining me. Thank you to Rabbi Jacob Romans, David Hachhauser, own the OU. Have a great day.